Blog Talk Radio.
This is Marty Oakley of the PPJ Gazette Online, and this is the TS Radio Network. Our show tonight is Whistleblowers. It's the USDA Hour, and it's brought to you in coordination with Marcel Reed and the Whistleblower Summit. And that takes place at the end of July every year in Washington, D.C., and you are all cordially invited. And you need to come out there and have a good time. Lawrence, do you or Tanya, one of you have this on speakerphone? If you do, would you cut back off of that, please? Because it'll give us feedback. And there we go. That's all right. So, and of course, co-hosting with me tonight is Lawrence Lucas. Lawrence, I'm going to let you introduce Tanya and take it over from there. Lawrence?
Yes, I'm here.
Talk to us. We're off to a rocking good start here. This, everyone, is Lawrence Lucas, who seems to hesitate a little bit about coming on air every once in a while. And our guest this evening is Tanya Ward Jordan. I had her name wrong on the promo previously for her book. And she has written a book called 17 Steps, A Federal Employee's Guide for Tackling Workplace Discrimination. And this lady knows her business. She's been through it all. With that, Lawrence, I'm going to let you pick this up and take it away.
Well, I would like to thank Tanya for coming on tonight with us. She is a civil rights pioneer. She has worked in the area of civil rights, and I'm going to have her to address many of the concerns and some of the things that I think the listening audience should be aware of. Most importantly, Tanya has come up with a book, 17 Steps, A Federal Employee's Guide for Tackling Workplace Discrimination. And we'll be talking about that book, but also we'll be trying to find out from Tanya what happened to get her so involved in civil rights and what happened to make her develop and write such an excellent document that can be used by many, many people who are in the civil rights process. The other thing out of the 17, she also covers learn how, and there were 10 items that we will have Tanya to talk about tonight and address. Tanya, I want to thank you for coming on the show tonight. The organization you represent, Civil Rights for Change, has been working in civil rights with different agencies around the country. And we know that you have a long history of civil rights. And what we'd like to do is, I want to thank you again, but I would like for you to kind of tell us, how did you get involved in the civil rights? And we'll track a path down to where you are today and the book that I think is a very excellent book for anyone involved in civil rights to read.
Okay, well, wonderful. Thank you. First off, before I begin and give you a little background on how I started, I just want to thank you, Lawrence Lucas and Marty Oakley, for inviting me to be on your show and for your activism. Yes, I am Tanya Ward Jordan, and as far as, I guess, early on, I have, I guess, a long career in federal service starting back in 1978, and, you know, like most young people, you think that you want to work, especially if you're in the Washington area like I am. This is a major employer. In fact, the federal government is the nation's largest employer by Department of Labor and EEOC standards. And so it was a place that I wanted to come to work, but I had no idea till years in, actually when I came to United States Department of Commerce, that I would face such overwhelming discrimination. And it was my experience at the Department of Commerce and later becoming one of three class agents representing over 5,000 African Americans who had alleged and had been claimed to have been denied promotions and awards and just fair treatment, just being a human being while employed with the federal government. I had firsthand experience with that. So after going through a long litigation process and suffering depression, anxiety, and withdrawal, I realized that what I was going through wasn't something that was isolated. I started talking to other people and found that they, too, who had been working in the federal government, were going through a similar situation. And so I wanted to start a support network. So I did start the Coalition for Change, Inc., C4C, and it's a support advocacy group for federal employees and applicants, who have faced discrimination. And I say specifically what we deal with at C4C is race discrimination and retaliation. And even though I'm a female who has faced discrimination, I had found that in the federal workplace, race discrimination is one of those areas that people really didn't want to talk about or to properly address. And so I wanted to keep that in the forefront, and that's what my organization aims to do.
Can I ask, Tanya, what specifically was done to you? And I know it wasn't just one thing. It was more than likely a series of events. But what did you personally encounter?
Oh, it was so many. But a number of things, starting with from ground zero when my supervisor was promoting a number of white individuals, many less qualified than myself. And when I asked him about an opportunity to excel, he told me that I was black and a woman, hadn't I read the paper. It was a time of diversity. I had winner, W-I-N-N-E-R, written across my forehead, and I could go someplace else to work. So that was right in my face, and it was just so overt. Now, everybody doesn't have it that overt like I do. A lot of times discrimination is a lot more subtle. But his was so blatant that the agency did settle that particular complaint with me. But I've had a number of complaints along the way. But another one that I found egregious and which impaired my health incredibly was when the department officials took me out of my position and made me report to a storage area to work, and it really further impaired my breathing and my mental state, and from there my health started to deteriorate. And you will find, and Lawrence knows this, and Marty, if you've heard this, and for sure, that once you start speaking out, you become a whistleblower, you expose abuses inside the federal government, inclusive of discrimination, you will face some backlash. And the backlash that I faced was put in the storage room. Now, I know other people, another colleague of mine was exposed to asbestos in the Department of Commerce building.
Oh.
And it was terrible, terrible, and it impaired his lungs and so forth. And here he was, a veteran, a returning veteran, and this is how he was treated when he engaged in discrimination. But these are not isolated cases. And so what I wanted to do is to collectively kind of put our heads together and see how we can address this overarching problem of discrimination that goes not just to commerce. It feeds throughout the federal government, and Lawrence knows this from being at agriculture. In fact, as I said, I've partnered with agriculture on a number of protest rallies and so forth because, in fact, some of the officials that I had to confront at Commerce actually came from the United States Department of Agriculture. And what you find in the government, you have these bad actors going from one agency to another agency because they're not really properly addressed when they engage in discrimination.
Tanya,
you know, I hear this in these. Go ahead, Lawrence.
Tanya, the one thing that I know there's a history with you. You also began to work with other groups and different agencies, as well as the NAACP. I would like to know, how did working with these different groups, especially the NAACP, how did that change your thinking about civil rights well before you had an opportunity to write your book?
Well, I appreciate you asking me that question. It changed me from a standpoint of, a lot of times we tend to look at micro, how things affect us individually or our little space. But when I began working with the NAACP, Federal Sector Task Force, and it was under a gentleman, as you know, Leroy Warren Jr. was the chair, and that particular organization, which unfortunately is no longer in existence, I mean the NAACP is, but the task force that specifically dealt with federal sector issues is now defunct. But what he did, Leroy, under the umbrella of the NAACP, he looked at all agencies across the board. So what that organization trained me to do, because I was a data group leader under Leroy Warren's task force, it trained me to look at issues from a broader scope, from a macro, not a micro, but a macro perspective. And so what I started doing is looking at data, statistics, repeat patterns that was going on throughout the federal government. So it gave me a good sense of what the culture truly was in the United States federal government, which is not just isolated to particular one agency. So it really did expand it for me that in that way with the NAACP. I further gained some additional insight when I partnered with the brilliant Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo, who you know, and she had a organization called the No Fear Coalition. And that organization, which I did was a very much a part of, was quite instrumental in the passage of the Notification and Federal Employee Anti-Discrimination Act of 2002. So that whole interacting with Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo and partnering to get that bill passed, I mean bill turned into law, was quite instrumental and gave me some additional material that I could share with others when I put together my book, 17 Steps.
Can I ask, Tanya, what I keep hearing from people coming out of these agencies where you've been the whistleblower and you filed legitimately a complaint about something that's going on, and you talked about them putting you in a storage area, and I've heard of employees being talked about they were put into closets, or they were put into these small cubby holes with no windows, no ventilation.
Right, right.
And given nothing to do. They have nothing to do, but in order to continue to be paid, they have to sit in there all day. This goes on in every agency. Now, to me, this is psychological torture.
Absolutely.
And I can't imagine what it's costing taxpayers for them to fund this kind of activity in these agencies to pay for you being tortured by being put in this storage area, for
right.
other people being put in the cubby holes. What's it costing us for this retaliation? And this is retaliation.
Retaliation in the federal government is costing the taxpayers millions, for one, and it's also costing, as Lawrence always says, the cost of efficiency and productivity. You know, we recently had a shutdown in government, and the public got to experience in a small way, in my view, what it's like when you don't have the civil servants working at its optimum. Civil services, when it's not working as its optimum, how it affects your food supply, your air travel, its safety, law enforcement, et cetera. So the public got a sense of that. But what they're not quite aware of as of yet, in my view, is even when the government is fully funded, how discrimination and retaliation is affecting the optimal production and quality of services that there are that the public is supposed to get. And that's something
yes.
to consider. I mean, the safety of our services, discrimination and retaliation really poses a domestic threat. That it's one of those unseen things that people have yet to really internalize. Of course, those of us on the inside, we get it. We understand it. And my focus is to be a messenger to get that information, one, out, to support the others, whistleblowers like myself, who seek to get that information out because we need a network of support. And thirdly, to provide some remedies, to come up with some solutions to address this problem. And in this vein, I'm very, very pleased to say that Congressman Elijah Cummings has been phenomenal in helping us, helping federal workers get some of these issues on the table in the forefront. And he recently reintroduced some legislation that the Coalition for Change came to him with to address some of these issues. And I will say, when in speaking with about the congressman from Baltimore, that I could not have done this alone without a colleague of mine. Her name is Paulette Taylor. She's our civil rights chair for the Coalition for Change, Inc., C4C. And Paulette happens to be a constituent of Congressman Cummings, and so she helped us get that foot in the door. And so we went to him about 4 years ago, and we told him, and he was well-versed. He knew a lot about the problems in the federal government, but we gave him a lot of anecdotal information because so many people contact C4C on our line because, again, we deal with agencies from agriculture to Veterans Affairs. And so we shared a number of stories with the congressman, and we also shared some, what we believe, some solutions to amend the No Fear Act of 2002. And with that in mind, the congressman put forward legislation again in just a couple, probably about a month or so ago, if that, to amend the No Fear of 2002.
Okay. Can I ask you, like with Trump, when he signed that, it was here, it was the day they fired Sean Higgins at the Memphis Hospital again, and it was an executive order about whistleblowers. How did that affect what you do and what these people go through?
Actually, I'm not familiar. If something happened today that I'm not aware of, I can't really respond to that.
This was a while back. Mm-hmm. A while back, Tanya, he had signed an executive order, and I'm trying to remember so that I don't misquote it, but it had to do with whistleblowers, and they portrayed it as though it was supposed to strengthen, you know, whistleblower protections, but actually what it did was reduce them, and he did it by executive order. He considers whistleblowers the same thing as people who leak national security secrets.
Mm.
You are not leaking national security secrets. You are talking about discrimination in the workplace on many levels, the failure to do your job, the waste, the fraud, the abuse that goes on, and that is not a national security issue in the sense that he's speaking about it or the government speaks about it. These are agency issues dealing with
right.
personnel.
You know,
and the other thing, go ahead.
No, I was just saying there's a number of efforts to undercut whistleblower protections. And one of the things I talk about in my book, we have to educate those persons who are looking for federal government employee, who are either federal government employees or who are seeking employment in the federal government. We need to educate them. And educate them, I mean this. They say that there's whistleblower protections, but the truth is, there's legislation out there, but really there's nothing presently that's going to protect you from retaliation. If you speak out, federal government, federal officials can, will, and do retaliate. But what I say
right.
in my book is you have to understand the parameters in which you're working. You have to understand when you pursue an EEO complaint, What does that really mean? And what does it really mean when they say that you have protections under these various legislations and under these very acts? Basically, it's saying that it's against the law to discriminate, and because of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, you have a remedy, which means you can go into court and challenge the discrimination. And if you're successful because of the Civil Rights Act of 1991, you can, if you prove intentional discrimination, you can get compensation for that. So you have a remedy, you have a recourse, but that doesn't mean they're not going to retaliate. Unfortunately, this is what I'm talking about. We work in a culture under the federal government, sadly enough. And EEOC is not immune to this. That's Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is not immune. I actually had a number, at least four EEOC individuals who work for the EEOC who has come to the C4C line and approached us and talked about problems they have from a morale standpoint to a retaliation standpoint where things are not working well within that particular agency either. And EEOC is supposed to be the one to enforce anti-discrimination laws, but yet we have it from insiders that they are actually just as culpable as some of the other agencies.
Tanya, we know that you have been around and seen and have talked to many individuals in these agencies in the federal government. What agencies do you think are some of the worst? And can you, based on your background and what you've heard and talking to your colleagues, what are some of the solutions that you think need to be put into place in order to get to this very systemic an abusive workplace, and I'm speaking of the federal government.
Okay. And in response to the two questions, okay, what agencies do I think is particularly the worst, and then two, what solutions would I put forward? I have, and this is based on, again, my experiences, and based on employees who happen to approach me from various agencies, I would say agriculture is way up there as being one of the most egregious agencies. Let's see, another one would commerce, clearly from where I worked. Interior is interesting. Interior does not have a lot of African Americans from a race discrimination standpoint, because again, we study race discrimination retaliation in the Coalition for Change. And even though Interior has a small population, because they're not really recruiting or retaining African Americans and other minorities as across the board. And the ones that they do have there, they report that there's ill treatment at that agency, at the Interior. So I said agriculture, Interior, Commerce. EPA is another one, Environmental Protection Agency. VA, oh my goodness, how did I don't even know how I almost slept on Veterans Affairs. I get overwhelming a number of complaints with regard to VA. So those are those four or five that I named are the ones that I get on a recurring basis. And there are a few others that come trickle in, but it's those the ones that I mentioned. As far as some recommendations that I would continue to go forward with, and Coalition for Change has gone forward with, is we ideally would like discipline of these federal officials that engage in discriminatory treatment and retaliatory treatment. But the problem is when we went forward with that in regulation, or I should say in a bill, that's more properly how to address that, we found that when they got tweaked up into Congress, they weren't providing for due process. And so we want to make sure that anyone who is being recommended for discipline has due process to address that the discipline that is being imposed on them is fair and just. So that part has to be tweaked. But there are things that can be done. And we sat down with the EEOC And it doesn't even really take legislation to do many of the things that we suggested. And I will go through a couple of those. But EEOC, under Colton Haddon, because we actually sat down and met with Colton Haddon, who's the director of Office of Federal Operations under the EEOC, we sat down and met with him. And while he seemed receptive at the table, the EEOC has yet to implement the number of the recommendations that C4C went for. For example, the EEOC is supposed to have what is called a memorandum of understanding with the Office of Special Counsel. Why is that important? Well, EEOC, when they get a finding of discrimination, when they make a finding of discrimination, they're telling us that they cannot mandate discipline. They can't impose discipline. That's what EEOC has told us, straight up. Colton Haddon told us that he could make an agency discipline. Got that. So he said that comes from the Office of Special Counsel, so we researched that. And so what we suggested to EEOC, if you cannot impose discipline or mandate discipline, you need to be fulfilling that memorandum of understanding and forwarding all those cases of discrimination to the Office of Special Counsel, which is entrusted and can recommend discipline so that discipline can happen, because that's a big part of accountability. And so EEOC hasn't been doing that effectively. In fact, over the years, I think they had a memorandum of understanding for about 10 years, and I did a FOIA request and found out that they had referred zero at the time, zero, to OSC, Office of Special Counsel, for discipline. So they're not doing their job. And so one of the things that we put in this new proposed legislation that Congressman Cummings introduced is that those referrals will be made. They shall be made. So if the law got passed, EEOC would be required to send those findings of discrimination to the Office of Special Counsel so the OSC can take proper discipline. Another thing is about notation to official personnel folders. Right now, managers discriminate, and there's a finding of discrimination, and it's nowhere in their personnel folder. They're not accountable. So this proposed legislation is a recommendation that we went forward with, is that when there's a finding of discrimination, that it get placed in the person's official personnel folder. So that's another one. So I could name a couple of other recommendations we went forward to, but I'll open it up to anybody who may have a question about it at this time, or if there's something else you'd like me to cover.
Well, the Office of Civil Rights and the Office of General Counsel and all these federal agencies, you would think that knowing all the research and the reports and the and all that have been done internally and much of the oversight over the past 10 or 20 years, you would think that the Office of Civil Rights in these agencies who are supposed to have oversight over these agencies within their those departments inside the agency, you would think that the amount of money that taxpayers pay all these employees in these agencies and the Office of Civil Rights and the Office of General Counsel, it seems as though you would think that there would be some accountability. And if you have an oversight Office of Civil Rights managing all the agencies, you would think that civil rights would have improved by now. That being the case and knowing what we know, what is your response to that, based on your experience and the experience that you've had with your organization's involvement in all these agencies and seeing the universe? What is going on in these agencies when you have the Office of Civil Rights and you have the Office of General Counsel, who is supposed to protect whistleblowers and supposed to protect the rights of those people filing cases? What is your response to that?
Well, across the board, what I see is the Office of General Counsel is basically an arm for the, if it's a cabinet-level agency, the secretary of the department or if it's just a regular agency or a administration, they're the arm for that administrative director. They're not there, OGC, Office of General Counsel, is not there for the employee, nor is human resources there for the employee, nor is civil rights there really there for the employee, and that's one of the things I get into in my book. I kind of smiled and snickered a bit about the Office of Civil Rights and when you said, shouldn't they know better, and I agree with you, they should know better. But they ultimately, particularly for reporting purposes on discrimination and that kind of complaints, they report to the EEOC. And the EEOC is not doing anything, well, I don't want to say anything. They're not effectively, okay? They're not effectively doing their job. And a lot of times, particularly, you have 29 CFR, that's the 29 Code of Federal Regulations, which is basically outlines the federal complaint processing system. And the EEOC is supposed to enforce the regulations within the Code of Federal Regulations. Now, if a employee fails to comply with something in that regulation when they're filing a complaint, their complaints are tossed out. But if an agency misses a deadline, for example, agencies are supposed to investigate employees' complaints within 180 days. I have found throughout the federal government a number of federal agencies fail to investigate employees' complaints timely. They fail to meet that compliance investigative deadline of 180 days. And EEOC has rarely sanctions them for that. It is possible for someone who files a complaint to blow the whistle or whatnot to sit in that retaliatory, culture, toxic environment for a number of years, the way this system is working. And the Office of Civil Rights of these various agencies are basically turning a deaf ear to its employees. Now, I can speak to Commerce directly because I worked in an office and where I saw a lot of discrimination. And I said, I want to be a part of a change, you know, to make a difference. And I think it was Maya Angelou, the poet, said, if you see something that you need to change, change it. Or if you can't change it, change your attitude. Well, I wanted to change how I saw things working with regard to discrimination and how it was making people just sick, making the employees sick, and how it was negatively impacting the products and services that we were rendering. So when a position came up, and it gets back to the Office of Civil Rights, just to give you an example, when a position came up in Commerce in the Office of Civil Rights, it was a diversity manager position. And I said, well, wow, I want to lend my skills. I want to dedicate my talents to make this a better place to work so I can be productive and give back in an optimal way to the public. And so I applied for the job. And when I didn't hear back, and I heard through the grapevine that someone management picked got it, I called HR, the Human Resources Office, and I asked about that position in civil rights, as you said, Lawrence, civil rights. Well, I was told that the selecting official chose someone that had, and then I found out, chose someone who never even applied for the job. And I was told that management could do whatever they wanted. And I said, well, I thought this was a competitive position because that's the vacancy announcement I applied for. It said competitive announcement. And that HR official put me on hold, came back and told me that management can do what they want to and I could apply for another job. Well, I told him there's no need for me. There's no need for me to apply for another job if management can do what they want to. And that was a job in the in the Office of Civil Rights. And I'm thinking, if Office of Civil Rights is conducting their business like this, and they're supposed to be overseeing what's going on throughout the department, woe to those federal employees who work there. And that's what was operational in my Department of Commerce. And when speaking with other people from other federal agencies, I found resoundingly the same type of ill behavior going on in a lot of civil rights offices. fudging numbers, when fudging complaints, you know, dismissing complaints that are valid, when knowing that employees, a lot of them don't have money for attorneys and don't know how to, and a lot of times, unfortunately, an employee might have a good case of discrimination. However, they don't know how to state their basis or their claim, and therefore EEOC, or the Office of Civil Rights, I should say, for these individual departments, the Office of Civil Rights, they're not really going to, in a lot of cases, share with you the how-tos. And so that's why I took time out from my experience, from my pain, and from talking to other federal employees. I did this book, 17 Steps, A Federal Employee's Guide for Tackling Workplace Discrimination, which is available on Amazon. And in that book,
right,
I list a number of, give a couple of other accounts beyond Commerce, you know, from other agencies, other people who have had similar type of experiences and having to have faced discrimination and retaliation. Now, my one colleague, in fact, Paulette Taylor, when she stood up and she brought her issues to the Office of Civil Rights, but no matter what turns out, she finds a live rat on her desk after reporting discrimination, to intimidate her. And so these are the kinds of things we face, sadly enough, in the workplace, and attention needs to be focused on this, and we need to collectively come together. And that's why I'm so grateful that, Marty, you have given us the opportunity to speak on the matter, and Lawrence Lucas, he's been in the trenches. In fact, I know Lawrence from way back with our days in the NAACP Federal Sector Task Force. So, I do appreciate the activism.
Can I ask a question? And this is personal to me. Do you think whistleblowing extends outside of federal agencies?
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes, I absolutely do think whistleblowing extends outside of the federal arena. I particularly, because I'm 40 years in and I'm a longtime federal sector employee, my expertise and my purview, and I speak on federal whistleblowing. But as a member of the summit, annual whistleblower summit for civil and human rights that we have each year now under the leadership of Marcel Reed and Michael McCray, we have come together with a broader mix of whistleblowers where we have people from all different arenas. Now, I will say initially, just a little background, I actually got into the whole whistleblower tribunal summit thing, if you will, is when I was with part of No Fear Coalition. We actually, when the No Fear Act passed in 2002, we had a five-year anniversary to commemorate the legislation. And we had a tribunal there. And right on Capitol Hill, we invited the testimony of various workers. And it gets back to what you're saying, Marty, about outside the federal government. While most of our whistleblowers during that time in 2007 were federal workers, we did have others, like we had a group from the medical practitioners come in to blow the whistle and share their experience. We even had some people from the hip-hop community. We had people from the airline community, and we had some veterans, and that was early on. But the primary focus at that time happened to be federal. Now, since we moved from whistleblower tribunals to the full-fledged whistleblower summits under Michael McCray and Marcel Reed, we have vastly grown and broadened the scope of the whistleblowers. And I'm very interested in learning each year about various cases of what's going on in our communities. But again, my expertise and my knowledge focuses on federal whistleblowing.
I just wondered, like I say, for me it's a personal issue, and I've got people here, I got a Facebook page up, and I'm getting messages about it. You know, is it just confined to this? Your book, Tanya, could it be used outside of the workplace, the steps and guidelines you have in there? Could it be used outside of the workplace, even incrementally, to fight back against things that might be going on? Is it specific to?
I would definitely say it's a workplace guide specifically for federal workplace. But I would say that non-federal employees can learn from various chapters in the book. But it's an employment related book. It's nothing. Yeah, it's totally focused on employment matters.
I do believe, Tanya, that the private sector, in reading the book and looking at the 17 steps, as well as the 9 or 10 learn how to, I believe that they can glean a great deal. If the private sector read your book, I think it would be a good guide for them as well.
Right. Thank you for that, Lars.
Well,
like
show,
I said, so
seven,
you're right. There's 17 steps, and out of there, there's some steps that are, you know, that definitely that someone in the private sector could benefit from.
Right. It's a process. It's a process that we all need to learn to navigate the system, because when we're fighting what I fight, we're having to deal with these agencies. We're having to deal with these same people you're talking about many times, and so I was just wondering if you thought it would be, you know, I've promoted the book, of course, but I might recommend it even further. You know, I think the process, I'm always talking about process, learning the process and what you might encounter, how to get around that obstacle they throw up, and they throw up those obstacles everywhere. I still am just frustrated over hearing over and over again, like you being told that that person can do whatever they want to do. They have a specific job description. There are certain duties that are expected of them, and there is a certain conduct that is expected of them, but apparently those expectations are only out here in the public. When you get in the office, obviously, too many times they don't apply. And so how are you going to counter this? This is so blatant and it's so rampant. I don't understand how the government can function with all of this going on. How can these people, anybody, get anything done with all of this mess running in the background?
Correct, yeah. It imposes discrimination and retaliation that is not accounted for, right? It imposes a unbearable cost to the public from, like I said, efficiency, productivity, and money, millions of dollars.
Tanya, I'm also glad that you also mentioned about the work that Marsha Adebayo, as well as the whistleblower organization headed up by Marcel Reed and Michael McRae. I think one thing in those days, the one thing that Dr. Marsha Adebayo did do, she at one of the major big testimonials, she included not only she included customers as well as employees. She reached out to, and Marcel and Michael McRae has done the same thing. They've reached outside of the employment sector and have also looked at the discrimination and the abuse that's going on with minority farmers, especially black farmers. And I know one of those testimonials, which was chaired by Congresswoman Jackson Lee and Congressman Walter Fauntroy at the time, that was a day-long testimonial tribunal that dealt with and exposed a lot of what was going on, not only in the federal sector, but also in the private sector. Even veterans came and spoke about the kind of abuse that they were receiving and the discrimination they were receiving after serving this country as well.
Absolutely. I'm glad you quickened me to that. And that's one of the things I did touch upon, but I didn't say the farmers. And that's very critical because Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo definitely did reach out to the farmers as well as to the other communities I mentioned. In fact, I was looking today, Lawrence, and I actually have a picture from that early summit, and you're in it with Reverend Fontrey and and Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. So I'm quite familiar with what you're talking about.
Well, looking at the 17 steps, are there any steps that you think that are more important than others? In other words, if you want to say, well, look, the five major or the three major points that are made in the 17 steps are, do you have a preference, or are all of them about the same in terms of how you can navigate through this abusive civil rights process in the federal government?
Excellent question. 17 steps. I don't put them. They're all important, but I don't see them all as equal. They all interconnect, but they're not all equal. One of the key things I say, and I start off number one, is save for survival. And people don't realize the importance of that. And I know we don't have millions, but, and this is whether you go in the federal workplace or non-federal workplace, if you're a person who has morals and you're the kind of person who does not like injustice and you're not going to just go along to get along when you see someone being mistreated, and you're the type of person who speaks up for right, you need to start saving your money. Because I say that because if you come into the federal workplace, you might see something that is not right, and you might be inclined to speak out against it. And if you do, you'll find yourself odd man out, and you could very well be without a job, or if not without a job, you could very well be in need of an attorney. So saving for survival is a very important step. I say in the book, from the minute you, and I'm talking federal right now, from the minute you step foot in the federal government, I don't care if it's a coin jar, I would start stashing away a dollar a day, whatever it takes, to put money aside. That's important. The second thing that I think is critically important is understanding the timeline. Because you can have the best case in the world within the federal government. You must state your claim within 45 days. You must report an incident of discrimination within 45 days. If you do it on the 46th day, your civil rights personnel, they could care less. They will toss your case like dirty bathwater. You have to know the time frames. And under the No Fear Act of 2002, the agencies are supposed to be doing training for federal employees. But sadly enough, they're not doing, from what I'm hearing across the board, they're not doing effective training at all. Some of them will put some information online and just let you key it on through. But to sit down, talk to you, really go through the process with you is not being done. So key is, going back to what you asked me, Lawrence, what as far as a key step, it would indeed be learning the time frames. And so I say save for survival and learning the time frames are two of the key processes. And then I'm going to skip around and say a third one, which is very important. And why is it important? It's knowing who the players are. I call it knowing who the players are. And I get into an early player you mentioned, which is the people in the Office of Civil Rights and the people in HR. You have to know the people you're going to be engaged with when you start taking on an EEO complaint. And that's important because a lot of us feel, oh, I got a good case. I just run into this Office of Civil Rights. And then once I tell them the egregiousness of what's going on and what my supervisor is doing to me or the harassments I've been involved in, somebody will come to my rescue. Somebody will do the right thing. And then when we find out that either HR or OCR, Office of Civil Rights, really is another arm for the federal government, we become despondent. We get devastated. We get depressed. So I really get into know the players in this book because one can really suffer from depression. That's where I meant to go. Discrimination, unfortunately, will lead to depression in a lot of cases. But I say know the players because it's nothing worse than you entrusting with your case and your livelihood, and they turn around and basically stab you in the back. And then you're really, really in a worse state mentally than you were when you went into this EEO complaint process.
Okay,
so,
Tanya,
again, just
quickly, we have a caller on here, code 240. You're live and on the air. Do you have a question and comment for Tanya?
Yes, this is Dennis Young, Tanya.
Hi, Dennis. How are you doing?
Thanks for calling in. Yes.
Dennis goes with us way back to the No Fear movement.
Right.
Ah. Okay.
Yes. I think what we should try to do is to slay racism. That is a problem.
Yeah.
If we can get rid of racism, then we get rid of all these problems.
Oh, you know, that's going to, sadly enough, Dennis, I don't think we're going to see it in my life. I think, sadly enough, I have to say this, but it's going to be here. It's going to be here. Now, what we have to learn to do is how to address it most effectively in the workplace, and because we're talking about workplace right now. Of course, we need it in housing and other areas as well. But
we need
to talk about how to address it, to hold those persons who engage in racial discrimination and other forms of discrimination accountable. But I don't think we'll ever, ever get away from, sadly enough, the racism that exists in America.
I know that. But we can reduce it if we really attack it.
Yeah, we can attack it. Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. And it is important to confront it when it does rear up, and it does rear up.
It is
important. And don't take it and walk away. There's no need to do that, and it should not happen. But I agree with you, Tanya. It will never, we'll never see it eradicated, not in your lifetime, mine. For some reason, it seems very necessary for some people to engage in it, and they seem to pass that on to their children, which I think is unfortunate. But, Dennis, thank you for calling in. I appreciate it. Tanya, we have got we've got about 8 minutes left here. Is there anything you want to add to about your book, you know, what you're going to be doing next? You mentioned possibly writing a second book.
Yes, indeed. Well, what I will say right now is that 17 Steps of Federal Employees Guide for Tackling Workplace Discrimination is available on Amazon. Anybody can go up online and to take a look at it. Or they can go to I have a personal website, just TanyaWardJordan.com, and they can read more about what the book's about and some of the other activities I'm involved in. But like I did kind of share with you, Marty, I did this book to help federal workers and applicants who may choose a career in federal service. The next book I'm working on is actually dealing with the toxic culture and letting the public know how the products and services that are going on in the federal government are impaired due to the toxic culture and how that affects them. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Well, you know, when you think about the federal budget and what they budget for all of these agencies and the millions and millions and millions of dollars, how much money could be saved if people just did their job?
And if they just didn't engage.
Go ahead.
No, I meant to tell everyone who's listening, if they wanted to get an insight on some of the cost of retaliation and discrimination, EEOC has to do what's called a performance and accountability report each year, performance accountability report. They just did in November their 2018 performance and accountability report, and they talk about discrimination in the private sector as well as discrimination in the public sector, federal government. They say that in 2018 they wind up just in payouts alone because of discrimination was almost $99 million. That's just for the payouts. We're not even getting into things, you know, the cost of investigations and all kinds of other things to keep this sick engine going. So, but the Performance Accountability Report of 2018 EEOC is something that people might want to take a look at.
No, Tanya, there was one other thing that I'd like to address. What do you think about an agency like EEOC who conducts and investigate or look into discrimination complaints at other agencies? And they find, and the individuals that come to them and file with them, what do you think about when the results of that on a year-to-year basis, they many times have 200 and 300 cases that they look at, and they only find 2 or 3 or 6 or 7 cases, and I've known them to do a number of years only 2 cases where they have found the agency guilty of discrimination. What do you think about that, as well as when the agencies themselves do the same thing, and through their investigations, out of 200 and 300 cases, they only find 1 or 2 cases and sometimes 0 findings of discrimination? Before you get off, can you give me your feeling on that?
Lawrence, I think there's a there are actually thousands of complaints filed each year, and very few, small percentage, if maybe 2% of findings, anywhere between 2 to 5% of findings of discrimination may exist within these various agencies. I think that a big reason for that, part of the reasons for that, is the agencies are not really being effective stewards in overseeing or enforcing the civil rights laws. And I don't, and I also think, and that's why I wrote the book as well. It's a failure of the departments for not finding discrimination. But then we have to educate ourselves as well, because there, like, goes back to the timeline. The agencies are quick to find out or to rule out or to dismiss our cases, and they look for ways to dismiss our cases. And if we don't file timely, or if we don't word a claim the right way, they will dismiss it. But on the other side of it, the agencies are culprits too, because you can actually properly state your claim, and they may rewrite your claim. And so it'll be incumbent on us to really check those persons in the EEO office. And that's why I get into the book about know the players and know how to properly state your claim and to even review the document that comes back from the Office of Civil Rights to make sure that they capture the essence of what you're reporting.
We have got more callers on here, but we've only got 3 minutes left, so let's do these really quick. Area code 703, your number ends in 94. Do you have a question or comment?
Hello.
Apparently not. Okay, we've got 703 ending in 41.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, my name is Kirk Webb. And I'm calling. I have something that I would like to say.
Yeah, whatever you have playing in the background, please turn it off. Please turn it off. Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tanya. We've got about 2 minutes left here. The call dropped. I'm sorry about that. I want to thank you for coming on. Just a bit informative. I wish we'd had scheduled a little more time so we could get into this a little further. What upset me about what you just said is they would rewrite your complaint.
And for what reason
they do that, and that's just to mess you up, right?
Just to mess you up. But I know we just have a short amount of time, and so I want to thank you, Marty, and Lawrence, for inviting me on. But before we close, I just want to say, you know, the Coalition for Change, Inc., C4C, was set up as a support network to help federal employees who are suffering from workplace discrimination and also to come up with some solutions to address it. And we were encouraged when President Obama came on the scene with this quote, and I just want to leave you with 2 quotes, in fact. One was from President Obama, and he said, "Change will not come if we wait for some other person or if we wait for some other time. We are the ones we've been waiting for, and we are the change we seek." So I live and I give to my service understanding that we cannot wait. And the second thing that I live by is incredible change happens in your life when you decide to take control of what you have power over instead of craving control over power that you don't. And so
excellently
that's important.
Said,
a lot of times we focus
Tanya,
on things that we don't have control over. We have powerful control over things, and we need to focus on those things that we do.
Great.
We've got
great.
About 25 seconds left here. Thank you both, Lawrence Lucas and Tanya Ward-Jordan, for coming on this evening. This is very informative. I want to recommend the book, again, The Whistleblower Summit, the end of July. Marcel Reed co-hosts or coordinates these shows. Everybody, if you can be there, be there. And we'll see you again next week. Good night, everyone.
All right. Good night.
Good night, and thank you, Tanya.
Thank you.